This is Talk To Me, the podcast that gives you rants, anecdotes, and interviews with people from hardcore to hair metal. And now your hosts, Joshua Toomey and John Drake.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Talk To Me. This is episode 120. I am your host, Joshua Toomey, and joined, as always, with...
John Drake. What's up, everybody?
What's going on, John? All right, our...
Not too much.
Our guest this week is the mighty Max Cavalera of Soulfly. They're going out on tour doing the Nailbomb album Point Blank in its entirety. I'm pretty excited about that conversation and that tour. And then after we talk to Max, we will talk to Greg Renoff, author of Van Halen Rising and the author of the upcoming Ted Templeman. So that book will be coming out soon. So a little bit of history with Max Cavalera. Do you have any history with Max Cavalera?
Yeah, actually, when I was getting into metal, the Chaos AD record and Arise were... It was kind of interesting because I found Chaos AD and I was like, oh, this is cool, because it was a little more modern style. It's when they kind of streamlined the sound and simplified a little bit in the favor of a little more power and groove. And I went back and found the Arise record, and that's one of my all-time favorite metal records ever. So
absolutely.
I was a big fan of early Sepultura. So, you know, right around the stuff after Roots, I kind of lost interest a little bit, but they're still really good. I just saw them opening for Testament a few months ago and they were kick ass. So, you know, I mean, that's obviously without Max, but
yeah,
you know, their stuff has been solid even without Max.
Yeah, I've been I definitely was a person that went with Max to Soulfly. I couldn't name five Sepultura songs post Roots, I don't think, if you asked me to. So but I'm a huge fan of Max Cavalera, and this will be his second time on the podcast, so I'm excited to talk to Max once again.
I got his biography, and I read that pretty recently, and it's a fantastic read. So he's definitely got a really cool story, and if there's ever one of those guys that just flies the flag of metal, it's definitely Max. And one thing I'd be interested to hear about is that Killer Be Killed project, because I fucking love that record. That was kick-ass.
Yeah, that was great stuff. And then we'll move on to Greg Renoff, who I got a chance to talk to at the Rock and Pod Expo. He was down there hawking his book, Van Halen Rising, for everyone that was there. And we actually talked there for a little bit about Van Halen, but obviously that was some of the drunken audio that I'm not going to use. So it's going to be nice to talk to Greg in a more sober state.
Yeah, I've got my copy of the book right next to me, my officially autographed version from VanHalenStore.com. So I'm a huge fan of that book. I've read it a bunch of times. So I am really looking forward to talking to him.
Awesome, man. Well, let's jump into our iTunes review for the week, and then we'll do shout outs for sharing, and then we will get Max on the line and then talk to Greg. So all right, we get to the Great White North of Canada for this one. This is from Lee from Tramps Like Us podcast. 5 stars. Title is just Rock and Roll, and it says, great entertainment for rock and roll fans. I listen to every episode. You should, too. Love this show. Nice and short and sweet. Thanks, Lee, and make sure to check out his podcast, Tramps Like Us.
Very cool. Thanks for the good review. Is that our first review from another country? I know it is, since I've been on the show.
Since you've been on, yeah, there's been there's another Canadian one and an Australian one. I believe that's the only two foreign ones that I can think of. But yeah, there's been
still
one.
Not too shabby.
All right, and let's do shout-outs for sharing. That is shout-outs for sharing on Facebook and Twitter. If you see this pop up in your Facebook timeline, your Twitter feed, you make sure to hit that share button, hit that retweet button, and you will get shouted out on the next episode of the Talk To Me podcast. Get ready, because this is a long one. Because
all right,
well, because I also posted some Louder Than Life mini episodes, and then I also posted the Steven Adler Wendy Dio interview that I did. I did that yesterday as we recorded. Did that on Monday. Posted it last night, and Jesus Christ, did it go crazy. So
well, you get the ex-drummer from Guns N' Roses, and you're bound to get some coverage, so.
Well, yeah, you get the ex-drummer from Guns N' Roses saying that he would love to play in Guns N' Roses again, and yeah, that takes off. So, let's see. It was a fun interview, though. I don't know if you've checked that one out yet or not, but he was fun to talk to. So, This will include the Sean Drover of Active Defiance episode, Eddie Trunk episode, Jose Mangan episode, and the Stephen Adler and Wendy Dio episode. So let's start out with Sean Drover shared it, Active Defiance as well. Facebook page shared it, AC, that's at AAULT1 on Twitter. Discography discussion, thank you guys. Viking Girl, MDG Rock Photography, Dane Babineau, Andrew Magnata, and iHeartRadio. You'll dig this one. When iHeartRadio picks them up, they pretty much put them on all of their iHeartRadio, like, you know, Houston.iHeartRadio.coms and stuff. So 99X Cleveland shared it. They were one of them that shared it. I don't know if that's big or not up there. But, yeah, 99X Cleveland, MetalWanting.com, Eric Moore. Got to give a huge shout-out to Blobbermouth for not only the Sean Drover episode, but the Stephen Adler episode. Rico Kohler, Joel Baggett, Pete Rock, Donnie Greenwell, Terrell Big T Sather, Danny Gilliatt, Cobras and Fire Podcast, host of Cobras and Fire, Jason Bakken, Sonny Pooney, Growing Up Rock Podcast, Chris Sinzak, Metal News with a Z.com, Six Sense, that's Nikki Six's stuff there, and Hard Rock, wow. Hard Rock Live. They also shared it to Hard Rock Radio Live shared it. So, man, tons of coverage over the last week. Thank you guys for everyone out there for sharing.
That's awesome. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, I got a little nuts, man, and it's still going. I mean, obviously that Stephen Adler story is pretty much new. You know, it's low hanging fruit, as Aiken and I like to say. But hey, it gets us coverage,
right? Just get the numbers. Just get the numbers.
Yeah, and those numbers are through the roof right now.
Perfect. As well they should be.
That's right. We get numbers here at Talk To Me Podcast.
Right. By using the low-hanging fruit, we are whores for numbers.
Yeah, you get Sean Drover talking about Megadeth and Stephen Adler talking about, you know, wanting to get back in Guns N' Roses. Yeah, you could get some low-hanging fruit there. As I said there, we shared the Eddie Trunk and the Jose Mangan episodes. It was great to kind of talk to those types at Louder Than Life over the weekend and see the other guys, the big boys, kind of walking around and stuff like that, and get to talk to everybody, you know, in this field, you know, peers or not. It was cool, man. It was cool chatting with Eddie Trunk. You know, he was probably one of the reasons I started this show.
Yeah, it was kind of funny seeing all your Facebook posts, because I was actually playing a festival. And I was like, look how cool I am. There's like 4,000 people in front of me. And then I'm looking at your Facebook page, and I'm like, ah, crap. It's not even the coolest thing either of us is doing this weekend.
You were definitely so, cooler than me on this weekend. I saw some of the pictures. It was crazy.
Yeah, it was quite insane. But when you're talking all the big names that you were, that was a blast. So did you get to see any of the show, or were you just in the media tent?
No, I saw part of the show. I didn't jump out for a whole lot. I would kind of go out and watch a few songs and then kind of go back. And I had so many interviews lined up, and you know, you just kind of, you're not only waiting back there for your setup interviews, you're also kind of back there hoping, you know, a straggler walks through, like the guys in like Mastodon walked by, and I didn't get to talk to him, but you know, I got to see him. And John 5 actually came through, and he's been on the podcast before, and I had a story about, he told a story on the podcast about the little boy that he saw in Hee Haw that made him want to play guitar. And a friend of mine is in the bluegrass industry, and he posted a picture of this kid the other day as kind of like a joke, like, hey, blah, 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 do you know who this is? And it turned out to be this kid named Jimmy Henley is the kid's name. And the guy that my friend was talking to was Jimmy Henley's best friend. And I jokingly wrote on there, I was like, is that Jimmy Henley? And I told him the whole story about John 5, telling the, you know, basically saying that that's what made him want to play guitar story. And my friend that's in the bluegrass industry knows who John 5 is. He was like, oh, man, that's amazing. And they kind of went back and forth. And I told John 5 that, and John 5 just straight up gave me his phone number and said, if you can get it to Jimmy Henley, do it. And I'm like, all right. So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I was like,
I may sell this too, but I'll see what it can do.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's the same phone number that I called for his interview, but it's still funny when he just, you know, basically takes my cell phone and puts his cell phone number into my phone. And it's like, you know, if you can get this to Jimmy Henley, you do it. So I'm currently working on that. And hopefully if it all comes through, we'll have a cool story for the podcast and make sure John 5 comes back on to tell me how it went.
Well, that's a pretty cool get, man, because John 5 is fantastic. Definitely one of the best guitar players working right now.
Yeah.
Easily in the last 10, 15 years.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. But yeah, man, the overall, the show was really good. The headliners that night were Ozzy and Five Finger Death Punch and Rob Zombie and like Gojira was there stuff. So I caught all the headliners. Ozzy started out really, really good. And then at some point he must've just like swallowed something the wrong way or coughed the wrong way or something, but he turned into sounding like a 14-year-old boy going through puberty. And it was hard to watch. You could see it like when they would zoom in on his face on the Jumbotron, you could just see it in his face that he knew too. And like everybody was just like, oh man. Like, but I mean, you know, Zach's up there killing it. And it was great to see Ozzy and Zach play together, but it was sad to kind of see him in that fashion.
Yeah. I think that's, unfortunately, that's really, you know, he's just at that point in his career where it's like, how much money do you need? Really, the only reason to go see him anymore is if you're into that really heavy guitar stuff. I mean, he's tuned to Q or whatever, you know, it's, yeah. I mean, so to hear all the Ozzy material really drop tuned and just brutally heavy is, I mean, that's really the allure of going, because if you're going as a fan of Ozzy, you know, his voice just isn't there anymore.
Yeah, it was all over the place. But, you know, like I said, I'd seen him tons of times over the years. I don't think I've ever got to actually see him with Ozzy's or with Zach. So, you know, that was a great part to see him, to be able to see those two guys together. And, you know, as musically, it was, you know, killer. Plus, you know, Blasco up there playing bass, stuff like that. So, yeah, it was fun to see. The other thing before we get into, you know, get into our conversation with Max is being at the festival, I did kind of sit back and this is obviously pre Vegas. And I did have a thought. I was like, man, it would be crazy if anything happened here. You know, getting a large group of people like that together, it's a scary proposition these days. And for all the things that happened Sunday night in Las Vegas, you know, no matter what kind of music was playing at the time, I know it was Jason Aldean, I know it was a country concert, but you know, you don't want anybody to go through anything like that. And to watch all the videos, I've been watching countless videos of people just, I don't even understand how people can have the thought to hit record on their phone, to sit there and record some of that. But, you know, that's the thing with tragedies these days is now they're being filmed, you know, because when you hear 50 dead, 500 shot or 600 shot, you know, those are just numbers. But when you're watching a video clip of, you know, someone just actually sitting there filming it while it's happening, it brings it closer to home. And, you know, we go to concerts to have fun. We don't go to concerts and you know, maybe think that's going to be the last thing we do.
Yeah, it's definitely just, you know, and the one thing I keep seeing online, which I think is just asinine, is like, you know, conspiracy theories of, well, this doesn't add up and this, that, and the other. And unfortunately, the reality is that we live in a world where sometimes there are sick, evil, twisted assholes that will do things like this. And you know, I feel the same way you do, that it's, you know, you're just going to a show. I mean, you're going there to have a good time and check out one of your favorite bands or something. And how do you know you might not come home? Or, you know, you're going to be doing CPR on a stranger or using your body as a shield or whatever. You know, a lot of people did. I mean, it's just, it's a horrible thing. I woke up to it on Monday morning. I was like, what in the hell? And then as you were reading all the news reports and everything, the number just keeps going up and up and up. I mean, it's like almost 600 people total. It's just unbelievable. So, yeah, definitely thoughts and prayers to everybody, anybody affected. I mean, it's just a horrible, horrible thing.
Not to bring it down too much, but let's go ahead and jump into the Talk To Me cover of the week and to get our minds on some music and get our minds on some Max Cavalera. And then, like I said, we'll jump right into our talk with Greg Renoff, of great author of Van Halen Rising. So I was thinking we're going to have some Max Cavalera, and we got to do a Soulfly cover. So we'll do Soulfly's cover of Helmets in the Meantime, which is one of my favorite bands, covering one of my favorite bands. So that's going to be nice. So for the Talk To Me cover of the week this week, brought to you by puckhockey.com. That's puckhcky.com. Make sure to head over there, shop till you drop. Use the promo code TALK at checkout for 10% off your order. Yes, that is TALK as in Talk To Me for 10% off your entire order. The Talk To Me cover of the week this week is Soulfly covering Helmet, and the song is In the Meantime.
Hello, everybody. This is Max Cavalera, Soulfly, and you are listening to Talk To Me. Stay metal. Oi! We'll be right back.
right, guys, that was Soulfly with In the Meantime. And in the meantime, we have Max Cavalera himself on the line. How you doing, Max?
I'm doing great, man. Good to be here talking to you guys.
Thank you, thank you. Well, we'll start out with that, and we'll get into other stuff later. But what made you guys decide to do a cover of Helmets in the Meantime?
Well, we toured with them back in the Ministry Sepultura tour, and that was always my favorite song they play. It was so heavy and catchy, and I always loved Helmet. I thought they were a great band. You know, they were just those stop-and-go kind of riffs.
Yes,
that were always
yes.
really, for me, it was really cool. So I think it came out of there, like from watching them every night and hearing the song stuck in my head. And it was like, I love cover songs. I love doing cover songs. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be like an older song. Mm-hmm. Sabbath, Zeppelin, or it can be something more like obscure hardcore like Dead Kennedys. But this time was we picked Helmet, and it was great. It was a lot of fun recording. It was during the Prophecy record, and I think it came out really cool. It's a good song. I really love the song, and I think we did justice to the original.
Absolutely, and I think I can credit you for making me kind of go back and check out the you know, the Dead Kennedys with the Holiday in Cambodia cover, and even kind of going into Motorhead. You know, Orgasmotron for a long time to me was a Sepultura song. It wasn't a Motorhead song, so I credit you for making me go back and learn my history.
That's funny. Some of those covers, sometimes you hear a cover and you don't even know of the original or think of the original until you go back and listen to it. You know, I think for me that was the case of there was a Slayer Judas Priest song that they did. I forgot the name of it now, but I think I didn't knew the Judas Priest version. I went back and listened to it. It was so different. The Slayer one was much heavier, of course,
right.
You know. The Priest one, the guitars didn't have much distortion. And that's one of the cool things about covering Dead Kennedys and Black Flag. The era of punk, the guitars have not much distortion, and they're almost like a little overdrive.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost like clean guitars. So when you make heavy versions of the songs, it just sounds killer. It just sounds great. You know, we end up doing a cover of Dead Kennedys for Alternative Tentacles' Virus 100 album. And we did Drug Me, and it was great. Just like, it sounds like a Sepultura song, like going 100 miles an hour. But you listen to the original, and it's like, it's clean. The guitars are clean. It's so funny to hear that back now, you know. So it's cool to cover stuff that is not real heavy, and you make it heavy.
Absolutely. And I think the kings of that are Metallica. I think there are tons of songs out there that you don't even realize that aren't Metallica songs that are actually, you know, old Diamond Head songs or whatnot.
Yeah, those are always really good. The Blitzkrieg and Am I Evil, you know, all those came out really, and I love Garage Days. I thought that was a great EP idea.
Yes.
The original Garage Days, that had, you know, the Misfits cover and Killing Joke. That was great. That was a great EP. I love that.
Yeah, I still love that album and that EP myself. So jumping into what we're talking about today is, you know, Soulfly is going out on tour, and you guys are going to do Nail Bomb's Point Blank in its entirety. And I have to say, looking back at 15-year-old me, you know, I had the Nail Bomb shirts, I had the Nail Bomb albums, both the studio album and the live album. So, I mean, of all people, I think I'm probably one of the more stoked people out there for this tour to happen.
It's really cool, man. It's a good time for it too, because we just came out of the Roots tour, which was great. It was very successful, and we just had a really good time on it. And it was like, it was real fun playing a lot of those songs, and it made us realize that maybe it was it would be a good idea to do something else. That's how the Nail Bomb idea was. Kind of came to life, and it was actually my wife's Gloria idea. And she thought we should give it a try. Having as a Soulfly playing, that's the twist of it, that Soulfly playing the Nailbomb album. And at first I wasn't quite sure. I gave it a little bit more thought, and then I realized that could be really cool because Point Blank, the record was done as a project, but now we get to turn it into a band, you know, so we can turn that album into a band format and play as if it were a touring album that if you just release Point Blank and you're going on tour with Point Blank. And it's a killer album. It's a great album to play live. So I think it's going to translate great. And I think I'm super excited to play stuff that we never played before, like 24-Hour Bullshit, For Fuck's Sake, Shit Piñata. You know, those are like my favorite tracks. And then the ones that people already kind of know because we play already, like Wasting Away, Cockroaches, Some of Your Achievements. But the whole record is real energetic, real powerful. And playing as a band, it kicks ass because it's got that power of Soulfly that people love. And then you got Point Blank on top of it with all the samplers. It's amazing. It's going to be an amazing tour.
Looks like it's going to be amazing tours. It does say that Alex Newport is not involved in this. Is he going to at least jump up maybe once or twice on this tour, or is he just out of it altogether?
I wouldn't count on him coming. He don't like to play live, man. You know, he never. Like, it's one of the things when we made the band. I was talking to him one day, and he like mentioned something to me like that was it stuck in my mind as one of the weirdest things I ever heard anybody say. He goes, "I hate the crowd noise," and I was like, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "You know, the crowd noise when you go on the stage and hear the roar of the crowd. I hate that." And I was like, "Really? Damn, that's a weird thing to say, you know." I never quite understood that, but now I see what he's a producer. He loves studio work, you know. He's not made for life. So I don't think that's gonna happen. But he gave his blessings, you know. Gloria was talking to him about this tour to make sure everything is cool with him, you know, for us doing this, and he was totally cool about it. He even gave her the list of the samplers that we needed, get it from the master tapes, and what kind of keyboard to buy it so we can get the best results to play live. So he was very helpful on the making of this tour. So we're really cool on that era, you know. So I love to do more stuff with that. I think it would have been cool to do another Nailbomb record, but we kind of left out in a really good place, too. You know, I think Point Blank is a classic cult album, and we get to play it live now, so I think that's going to be great.
Yeah, definitely kind of going back to it and listening to it again over the last couple of days, getting ready for today, and it was kind of funny how much I must have listened to that album back in 94, just because it all kind of came back to me. But it sounds like a good mix of Chaos AD, and it's like Chaos AD meets like a Ministry album or something. It's such a time capsule of that time.
Yeah, it was around that time, and, you know, it was like, I was really intrigued. My friendship with Alex was evolving around my love for Project Unknown, Hate Songs in E Minor especially, which was one of the heaviest albums I ever heard. And I was intrigued by his riffs, and I want him to show him his riffs, and that's how our friendship started. And he wanted me to show him how we do the chugging thrash riffs that Sepultura had. So I show him those. And from that on, we end up making the band, and I think it sounds a bit like, you know, we're listening to a lot of industrial stuff like that, Godflesh, Nine Inch Nails, Skinny Puppy, Frontline Assembly, you know.
Yeah, the Neubauten stuff, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of industrial shit, you know. But we want to make our own version of it. And I think there's a real Fudge Tunnel also in some song, like Sick Life. Cockroaches is definitely a Fudge Tunnel riff that Alex brought to the table. But yeah, I think what I love about the record, I think, is how relevant it is today, like how great it sounds today. That record sounds amazing. Even when I was, we went to a studio to get all the samplers from the master tapes, the guy in the studio was like, how long you guys record this? And I was like, yeah, it's more than 20 years ago. He's like, he couldn't believe how good it still sounded. It just sounds killer right now, you know. It's fresh. It still sounds great. It has not aged. Some albums with time, they lose the power that they had, and you listen back to it, it goes like, really? I thought this was heavy? This is not heavy anymore, you know? And some of it sounds like shit, like Sepultura and Morbid Vision just sounds like dog shit.
I wasn't going to say it. I wasn't going to say it, but...
That was out of tune, but it's just a different case. But Nelbum, no, that record sounds great, and it sounds even better live, man. We've been jamming, rehearsing. The rehearsals are going great, and I think people are going to be so stoked to hear the songs. I'm totally excited for it. I mean, I haven't been this excited about going on tour in a long time. I love the package. I think it's great. Cannibus Corpse, Noisem, Lodi Kong. It's an underground package for underground metal, and I think that's what we need. That's what Nelbum needs, because it's not as flashy as Roots. Roots was a different album, was a bigger album. Nelbum is more underground, more connected to the underground, so I think that's it's going to translate better with this package.
You were saying how that the Nelbum album is still kind of current these days, and one thing I went back to look at was I had the long sleeve shirt with the 100 Reasons to Hate on the back, and I found it online. I was looking at it online in a picture of it, and I was reading the Nelbum's 100 Reasons to Hate, and it's funny that in 2017 that 95 of those reasons are still valid. Nazis and the KKK and terrorists and corrupt politicians. I mean, it's crazy how, I guess the more things change, the more they stay the same type stuff.
Yeah, I think that album and the ideas that we, because that record, it was just a big fuck you to everything, it was a big middle finger to everything that we hated and didn't like it, and we call it, was first called The Hate Project, and we had the name of the album was going to be 1000% Hate. We took some pictures with some spray paint wall that said that. But yeah, it's so right now, it's like so perfect. It's more perfect now than it was, I think, when the album came out. Like the backdrop is a KKK guy with a target on his face. So I think that by itself is going to create a lot of controversy, just that, It's like, especially right now, this moment that we're living with Trump and everything that's going on, right now. So I think, I think it's perfect. I mean, and the songs, the subjects on the songs, also, guerrillas about war, 24-hour bullshit is about guns, pretty much, and, the whole gun debate. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the themes are relevant now more than ever, and I mean, that's going to be great. So it will feel great to play those songs, and I think apart from the energy and the vibe that we get from them, there's a little bit of a message behind a political kind of social political message, which I think is really cool, to a big fuck you to society right now. So I think that's always was Nelbum's point of view.
Yeah.
And it'll be great to play that shit live every night, man. It'll be a release of anger and energy that we all needed.
So I'm going to edit this up tonight and actually put it out tomorrow. So it's going to be very current with what's going on right now. And with, everything that happened in Vegas Sunday into Monday, you've made your career out of playing festivals and you've played a ton of them. The big thing that Nelbum ever did was play Dynamo. So it's, you're in festivals that, you see it all the time. How scary is that proposition to think, what happened at that festival in Las Vegas?
It's crazy. It's a crazy world, man. I don't know. It's just that kind of stuff is mind-blowing that shit like that happens, man, And we play this festivals all the time, every year pretty much in Europe.
Yeah.
We do the European summer festivals, and nothing like that ever happened. We saw what happened on the weekend. It's horrible, man. It's like that didn't have to happen. It's just so crazy. I mean, and there's nothing really much you can do about that. It's like it's a hard situation. It's a hard to prevent kind of thing. It's just messed up, man, but what we cannot let it happen is to stop. The festival's got to continue. The show has to continue. People cannot stop playing live from fear of that. Otherwise, we lost the battle, you know. I'm kind of like, I'm kind of full on, like, even when the Paris shooting happened, we played Paris like a month after that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were on the first bands to play Paris, so it was a big deal. And I was so proud to be back and playing for those people. And they needed to. They needed that anger. They needed that metal, you know, like to get that stuff out of them. So we had a great show. So why we cannot let it happen is let stop doing what you do because of that, because of fear. You know, fear is a powerful thing. If you let it control you, it can ruin your life. So we cannot let that happen. We have to continue to do what we do. Even with the risk of something like that happen, you have to carry on. You have to keep on going, keep on playing shows and going out there and giving the music to the fans, because that's what we're here for.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know it probably goes for the both of us, but our hearts go out to the victims' families and everyone that's recovering out there. That's you know, no matter if it was a country concert, a rap concert, a metal concert, you know, you don't go to a concert to die. You go to a concert to have a good time.
Yeah, it's sad. It's a real sad situation. You're right on it. It's I feel real bad for the families, for the people there. Like, you were just there to enjoy the show. I don't know much country. I don't like much. But like you say, nobody should ever go to a show and get killed like that for no reason.
Right.
It's ridiculous. It's a horrible situation, you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah, you know, like, life goes on, man. We just got to keep going out there and playing.
Absolutely. And speaking of going out and playing, you know, like I said, you're going out and playing Point Blank in its entirety. Did you see such a good response from the Return to Roots stuff that this made you want to go out and do Point Blank in its entirety? And then does this lead into maybe doing more stuff like a Chaos AD in its entirety and Arise in its entirety and then even some of the Soulfly stuff?
Possibilities open. You know, we don't know what we're doing yet. We got a lot of stuff to in our hand to do, because we got Cavalera album come out in November. Psychosis, it came out really good. I'm really happy for it. I'm going to work on a new Soulfly for next year. We have the Nile tour, Soulfly Nile, next year. So we got a lot of stuff on our table. But eventually, from time to time, I love to do this. And I think that's what's going to be cool. From time to time, we're going to go and do this kind of nostalgic tours without stopping what you're doing. You're always keeping forward with your own bands. Killer BQ going to release another album sometime in the future. So we don't stop what we're doing, going always forward. But it's been, I have to say, the Roots experience was mind-blowing, how cool it was to go back to that record. And the appreciation the fans had for that was, like, we just came back from Australia. It was sold out everywhere. It was crazy, like Beatlemania kind of thing. And
that's great.
You know, Melbourne is a bit different. Like I say, it's more underground. So we don't want this to turn out to be a real big thing. It's cool. It's underground. Smaller venues. Let's go crazy. Let's go nuts. It's the shows I'm comfortable with. I love small places. I love small shows. As much as it's fun to do the big concerts, the big festivals, my heart is in the small show, the sweaty little dump, man.
Nice.
The smelliest the dump, the better the show is going to be, you know?
Kids right on top of you, it's got to be great.
You can feel the sweat of the fans hitting you, and you can touch them, and those are the best fucking shows. That's what metal is all about, is right there, the little club shows. Is what metal comes to life.
So last time we talked with the Return to Roots, you know, you've also done a Cavalera Conspiracy album since then. And, you know, just having Igor back in your life, I mean, is it still just an amazing thing for you?
It is. It's great. You know, I love Igor. I love my brother. And our relationship now is better than ever. Our new record is Kick-Ass. I love it. I don't know if people heard it yet. I know there's one song online, Insane. It's already on Spotify and stuff, but I can't wait for people to hear the whole record, because it's a beast. It's a beast of a record, and it's going to be a lot of fun playing that one live, too. So I'm looking forward to that. I have one more series of Roots tours in December with Overkill in Europe. We have two to three more weeks, And then we're done with Roots entirely. Like, I don't think we're going to touch that ever again. Maybe for a real special reason. But it's pretty much done. And then it's on into, you know, bigger, better things. You know,
nice.
Other projects, you know.
All right. And then one last question on this one is, you know, the Soulfly, the lineup is Mark Rizzo, Mike Leon, and your son Zion. Was Zion even born when Point Blank came out?
Yes, it's right
it's
there. it's on the. I mean, his heartbeat opens KOZP.
Right. That's what I was thinking about today. So
it's right there on the verge. I'm not sure. My dates are kind of fuzzy on
right
which one came out first, Chaos or Nail Bomb.
Well, Chaos AD was 93, so and Point Blank was 94, so.
Oh, so Nail Bomb came out. So he was born, yeah.
Okay.
He was 1 year old.
Well, that's great.
He was 1 year old getting ready for the life.
Absolutely, man. Well,
now he's jamming the album. He loves the record, by the way. He loves the Nail Bomb record. And like I say, the translation of the electronic songs into band songs, that's the coolest thing for me. Is what that got me more excited about this whole thing was I didn't know like how I was going to translate. Those were original electronic songs. And I was like, I don't know how a band's is gonna handle that. But once we play it, it was like, oh my God, it's a whole new song. It's like it's got the power of a band behind, like the power of Soulfly of a Soulfly song playing Word of Shit or Religious Cancer. It's got a band power, a band weight to that. And we have the electronic sounds on top of it so that it didn't lose anything of the electronic vibe. So it's pretty complete, man. I think people are going to be stoked when they hear it. I'm pretty excited.
And I can't wait to see it. Hopefully I get to check it out. I think you're coming near me, so I'll try to make it up. Tour starts October 6th in San Diego, ends November 11th in Tempe, Arizona. I want to finish this out with To Play 24-Hour Bullshit, and that features Dino from Fear Factory. Give me a quick story about how Dino got involved, and then I'll get you out of here.
Yeah, I always loved the Dino sound, man. You know, that Fear Factory, you know, groove. I love the demo, the Fear Factory demo. That's now, it's actually now out as Concrete, but it had that song, Be God. That was my favorite song they ever did. And I always loved Dino's riffs. I think for me, he's one of my favorite riff guys in the world. And I want him to do a song like that because to me, Fear Factory was part of that. Of that bands that were kind of doing what Nail Bomb was about, like the industrial metal type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't really hard to persuade. You know, we call him up and he came to Phoenix and did it, and it was great hanging out with Dino. Dino's a great guy. He's a really, really good friend. And I hope he'll be at the Whiskey Show, and we can give him the guitar to play 24-Hour Bullshit with us. That'll be great.
Well, that will be great. Well, Max Cavalera, thank you so much for taking the time tonight, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, brother. Keep it mad, Oil.
All right, you too, man. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Jeff Walker from Carcass, and you're listening to Josh on Talk To Me. Yeah.
Was Romeo Delight by the mighty Van Halen, and on the line right here on Talk To Me, we've got the mighty Greg Renoff, author of the fantastic new Van Halen book, Van Halen Rising, and future author of what is sure to be a juicy biography of Ted Templeman. What's going on, Greg?
Hey, thank you guys for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Not a problem. Thanks for coming on. So I've got my personal copy of the book next to me, so I wanted to thank you for autographing it. VanHalenStore.com is a great place to go get that. So it's a fantastic read. I've been through it several times. Starting at the beginning, basically the book is about Van Halen's days as a party band before they got a record deal in the mid-70s. Once you get the idea to tell a story like this, where do you start to try to find, you know, people to interview, all the pictures? How did that begin for you?
You know, I think it began for me with beginning with what the band had said, and that was sort of what sparked me. So one of the things that ended up being kind of a regular as part of my childhood was just reading every Van Halen interview I could get my hands on. You guys are rock fans, and so you know how that is. You just buy the magazines, you read them, and you read them over and over again. And there were parts of the interviews that always interested me was this idea of the band being, as you mentioned, a backyard party band. I always thought that was a cool part of their history. But if you go through the interviews that the band has done over the years, there's very little detail. I mean, it would just be someone ask Eddie a question. So what was it like when you guys were starting out in Pasadena? Oh, we used to play these backyard parties and we'd charge $1 for all you could drink, and we would play till the cops come, and or the helicopter would fly over and shut us down, and we would keep playing. And these types of stories, and that sort of got me interested in trying to learn more about that. And as I began to play with the idea of trying to write the book, I kind of realized that it was going to have to be with people in Pasadena. And that's sort of how it got going for me. Was I got in touch with some people, for example, a guy by the name of Tom Broderick. Tom is one of three or four Broderick brothers, and they all grew up with the Van Halens, basically like neighbors of the Van Halens. And Tom was actually Eddie's sound guy and went on the road for Van Halen for part of 1978. And he had done a couple of interviews with Jeff Houseman's Van Halen Inside magazine that used to be a fanzine that was out. Jeff now runs a great website, Van Halen News Desk and Van Halen Stories, you mentioned. And he had done an interview with Tom. And so Tom was one of the people I reached out to. And it, you know, there were a whole host of people sort of like that were in the Van Halen orbit and would sort of begin to set me on this path of writing this book to say, hey, you should really get in touch with this person as well. This person, played with Eddie and Alex in a band in 1968 when they were just like, you know, 13 years old or whatever. And so that was the kind of the beginning of this sort of taking all these pieces and then along the way trying to put it together. And so it was a long process, but yeah, it was never a matter of, well, I can knock this out in 6 months. I researched it over a long period of time. I didn't work on it every single day, obviously. I had a day job and was doing other stuff, but it was a matter of just kind of trying to figure out where the holes were and then trying to fill those holes by finding out who might be able to tell me pieces of the Van Halen story I didn't know.
How much stuff did you actually get? I mean, is everything you got in the book, or did you actually have more and you had to like pare it down?
There
was a 600-page monster on your hands.
There were some stuff that I ended up leaving out. I mean, one thing that's kind of funny that ended up happening was, I'll give you an example, that Van Halen in 1975 was actually playing in a converted, they would play on weekends with other bands at this converted bowling alley in Duarte, California. So you can imagine it's this space that now has the lanes still in it, but kind of all the bowling apparatus stuff has been pulled out and they turned it into a nightclub. You know, it's not exactly the Forum, and they would play in this thing every weekend. And actually one of the, this same guy, Tom Broderick, was one of the people who told me about this, and they would do these mini concerts in there, and you know, three bands would play over the course of the night. And he told me one of the things that he remembers very distinctly was that they, at the time, Van Halen had used smoke pots, and they were basically tuna cans that they would wire together and put black powder in them and have it like a little, they had a little board or a little button they would punch and would shoot a little electrical charge through the wires to the black powder in the tuna cans. And it would send that poof of smoke up, kind of like you could see in Led Zeppelin Song Remains the Same, that Kiss used to do, like a little tiny pop flash, and all the smoke would go off. And they actually would go into this, gun stores and buy the black powder, and they would take turns going into the, actually Michael Anthony told me that story, they would take turns going into the store because there was some law that you could only buy, I mean, I'll just make it up, like 2 ounces per person per day or something. So they would each like go in and buy this black powder. And so they set it off in this nightclub, and they must have miscalculated the amount of black powder to use. And if you know how a bowling alley is, the ceiling kind of typically slopes down towards the pins, and that's where the stage was set up, back where the pins used to be. And the smoke went off, and I guess there was so much smoke that everyone had to run out like gagging, like the guys were on their knees playing, trying to breathe. They were still playing the song and everyone had sort of run out. And so they ended up playing for like nobody for like 15, you know, they stopped the show and let the smoke air out. And so, you know, those are the types of stories that that didn't quite fit into the narrative of the book. And I, you know, I wish I could have done more with that. There was a couple of other things that I put out via, I have an email mailing list that I was using for the book and a couple of things on Facebook. Another one was Van Halen played this dance at this all girls. They used to do this regularly, but they would be hired to play a dance. This would be 1975, and it'd be, you know, senior goodbye dance. And one of the dances was at this all girls high school in Pasadena. And this guy who has a date of one of the girls who went to this prom or whatever it was, already told me about how, you know, Roth is, it was a Catholic all girls school, and Roth was up there like grinding in his leather pants, like doing these, you know, like these like hip rolls and like grinding back and forth, and all these nuns are standing there looking at this like who gave the okay to hire this band or whatever, you know. And so those are the types of things that, again, I would have had to sort of shoehorn into the book to make work. But yeah, there was a lot of there was a significant amount of material that just didn't quite fit that. Yeah. Like those two stories particularly stick out in my mind. They were funny, but just didn't quite fit in the book.
Yeah, definitely. Now, is there anything that in researching the book, I mean, obviously you've been a lifelong Van Halen fan, you know, and for someone like you, who's, as you said, read all the interviews, I know I've tried to do the same. Did you uncover anything that you didn't know that might have been actually pretty surprising or influential to their history that you hadn't already heard as such a big fan?
Yeah, one of the things that was a little bit surprising to me, and there's a bunch of things, but one of the things that comes to mind right now was I ended up interviewing a couple of guys who were friends of Dave Roth from before Van Halen. So before, Dave had a band called Red Ball Jet that preceded Van Halen. I have a whole chapter in Van Halen Rising about Red Ball Jet. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that these guys talked about was that after Dave's band broke up, Red Ball Jet, he had joined Van Halen. And Dave was really motivated to try to get the band to begin to try to graduate from backyard parties to playing nightclubs. Now, it wasn't going to be just a, you know, one day you're playing backyard parties and you playing clubs, but he wanted to try to get the band to do that. And the brothers were were less enthusiastic about this because I think they figured they're making good money playing backyard parties. Why would we go play nightclubs, make less money and work harder? But Roth was very motivated to do this. And this gentleman by the name of Bobby Hatch talked about the fact that he would help those guys. He would bring his pickup truck over, load up their stuff. They would load it into all the cars and they would drive and audition these clubs. And he would hang out during the auditions because, of course, they would have to load their gear back out and leave when the audition was done. He talked about how over and over again they were getting shot down by these nightclubs. And it, to me, that was just so hard for me to wrap my head around as a fan. But it sort of helped me understand the drive and motivation, particularly of Roth, to get the band to go to the next level, but also how unpolished they were as a cover band. And so I had to really get myself to understand what it meant to be a nightclub band in the 70s, which was basically meant that you replicated the songs of multiple artists really, really well, and then made people want to dance because the song sounded like the record. Now, it isn't exactly, you know, it wasn't necessarily note for note covers, but it was, the idea was that you were able to, like a wedding band basically does. You guys know how that is. Like a wedding band, they can do Casey and the Sunshine Band, they can do Prince, they can do all the ZZ Top, they do all the sort of, depending on how old the couple is, they do all the songs well. And Van Halen really wasn't particularly good at that. And that was one of the reasons why they kept getting knocked down. Eddie would go in there and play some soft rock song that ended up having it sounding like it had a Black Sabbath guitar line to it because he wasn't really mimicking the guitar line. And so they were not a particularly well suited for nightclubs. And so when I heard about these rejections over and over and over again, it was kind of surprising to me because I thought, oh, it's Van Halen. Of course, you know, the talent's going to shine through. But thinking about how long it took them to get into Gazzari's on the Sunset Strip in April 1974, they had been together with Roth for probably 8 or 9 months before that. And that whole autumn of 73, they're going all around LA trying to get these nightclub gigs and, you know, getting hired for one night, getting fired or basically getting rejected outright before they got this steady gig at Gazzari's, which is sort of their big foot in the door to be a band that was going to start playing nightclubs along with their other ways that they made money.
Hey, Greg, it's Joshua Toomey. We met there at the Nashville Rock and Pod Expo. It's good to talk to you again. kind of going back and trying to track down all of these people, how hard was it to find a lot of the guys that were kind of the names in the early days of Van Halen? And then once you found them, how hard was it to get them to talk about the early days of Van Halen?
So, yeah, I'll start with the second part first. Yeah, it was great to hang in Nashville. That was really a fun event, and looking forward to doing it again next year. So I hear that's the plan, so I'm excited. But yeah, how to get these folks to talk? I mean, for the most part, at the beginning, you know, when I first started doing the research, it's 2011, 2009, 2010, and in that ballpark, you could imagine initially you call this person and you say, hey, you know, you don't know me, but I've talked to a friend of yours. They suggested I call you and talk to you about the club era of basically the club era of Van Halen, or when you guys. In your band played with Van Halen at Starwood or at Gazzari's or the Whiskey, you know, of course, you know, people would be like, you know, who are you? You know, where do you live? Like that sort of, they were sort of this, what are you doing? Sort of these, initially these questions. But I found the more time I invested in the interviews and I built up a rapport with more and more people, it became relatively easy. And of course there were some people who wouldn't talk, you know, I can think like, you know, five or so people who maybe wouldn't talk for whatever reason. And I didn't, you know, for the most part, I didn't bother pursuing these people aggressively. I just said, hey, you know, no worries. If you change your mind, here's how to get in touch with me. And occasionally people would come back, but it wasn't that big of a deal. And I think for most of the people I talked to, once they realized that I was interested in trying to capture the vibe and the music that was going on and get across how much fun that period of time was, I think most of the people understood that they had been lucky to be in that time and place, not only because of Van Halen, but because bands like Quiet Riot, Stormer, Smile, these bands that didn't necessarily become a eulogy, become big, all produced some really, really talented musicians. You know, for example, Rusty Anderson, who was in a band called Eulogy. Eulogy never made it, but he's now Paul McCartney's guitarist. Tommy Gervin, who was in a band called Smile. Smile never made it big. They made one album for RCA in the 80s, but they never made it. Tommy Gervin's now Eddie Money's guitar player. And so I think they kind of understood the people who played on the scene or around that there was a really, really talented George Lynch, Randy Rhoads, a group of musicians around that period of time. And it was a great time. You know, we all have those periods of life we look back on fondly and go, man, that was the best time of my life. Or that was, you know, those were great times. I think for the vast majority of people, they kind of realized that going to see Van Halen play in a backyard in 1974, the sort of classic, you know, what I think of it like the Dazed and Confused era, wasn't a bad thing. I mean, it was a good time. And so I think a lot of people were really enthusiastic about the idea of trying to recapture that whole era in my book, not just sort of focusing solely on what happened with Van Halen, but talking about how these parties played out in town, how the cops responded to it, how Van Halen worked their way from, you know, basically playing back blacktops in playgrounds up to playing the Forum. I think that would being people knowing that they'd been taking any small part in that, whether it was, you know, whether they hosted a party or they went to a party or they, you know, saw those guys practice at Roth's basement one or two times. I think a lot of people think it's cool, just like we would think it was cool if, hey, you know, I was around when Led Zeppelin was getting started or The Who or Pearl Jam or any big rock band that made it huge. It'd be cool, a cool thing to be like, you know, I saw that kind of taking place. That was cool. And then the first part of the question was finding people. You know, one of the things I always say is that without Facebook, this book would have been extremely difficult to do the way I did because, you know, today you can begin to track people down by people saying, oh, yeah, that person's in my Facebook friends or find that person that way. Now, not everyone was available that way, but a lot of people were. And that sort of made it relatively easy in a lot of cases, at least to get a line on where people were so I could message them or give them a call and talk to them. And as I said, I think the building the rapport with people, I ended up now a lot of the people I interviewed for the book, I count among my friends because we spent a lot of time talking. They gave me pictures. We shared stories. And I think, you know, they're fans too. And I think that was the other thing that hopefully came through for people. I didn't write the book as going, oh, what would be a good, you know, what would be a really good band to write a book about be Van Halen because I want to make money or whatever. It was because I was a fan. You know, I grew up in a different, I'm 48 years old. And so I grew up in a different time period of as a fan. I didn't really get onto Van Halen until 1984. But of course, for those guys, it all came a decade earlier. And to kind of, I think to have that connection as a fan, they appreciated that too, that I was enthusiastic about the band and liked the band.
One of the things that I found most interesting about the book, not that people don't know this, that Eddie Van Halen is, you know, kind of a wunderkind, and even back in the day it was absolutely revolutionary. But I think one of the things that stands out most in the book is that in the early days, Roth was generally considered as kind of a bad singer, and really the calling card of the band was all about this crazy guitar player. When you were researching and writing this, did it change your perception of the band at all, discovering things like this and seeing how in the early days it was really based around Eddie more so than it was Dave's persona as it would later go on to be?
Yeah, you know, one thing that is maybe like a good comparison is, if you guys are sports fans or NFL fans, is they talk about, you know, when a player ends up peaking, and some guys, I'm a New York Jets fan, much to my chagrin year after year, but I am a Jets, diehard Jets fan. And, you know, they talk about someone like Tom Brady, who was a good college quarterback, but kind of peaked in the pros. And I think Roth's the same type of guy, where he really, yeah, he was considered to be the weak link by the vast majority of people who were fans of the band. And again, those are other, you know, those are Eddie and Alex's peers. It wasn't like they had a massive fan base like what they would have later all over the world. These are just people in LA who had seen Van Halen. And that was typically the response I got, that was that, you know, man, the guitar player in this band is revolutionary or unbelievable, or people saying, I couldn't believe this guy was like a local Jeff Beck and was just playing in this backyard. He was just so good. And guys like, I'll give you a classic example. Mark Kendall from Great White saw Van Halen in backyards and talked about that. Tracy G from Dio, same deal. I mean, started seeing this. And they saw Roth. And, you know, in terms of the vocals, it wasn't that strong. Now, one thing that Tracy G pointed out to me, and I thought it was a really good point, he's like, you know, but in some ways it didn't matter all that much because the band was so good. It was sort of, if you were evaluating the band from the standpoint of, I want to sign this band and make a record, give them a record deal, yeah, you might have been like, Roth's not a very good singer. He's not, you know, he's not going to sound like Boston. He's not going to sound like Foreigner. He's not going to sound like Deep Purple. He's not that type of classic FM AOR singer. But he's just, you know, he said Roth's good. You know, Tracy would say Roth was good with the girls. He was good with the people. He knew how to put on a show. And that was kind of made it all work. But yeah, just to think about the fact that Roth was sort of seen as like this guy who, you know, was a little bit out of the fit with the Van Halen brothers too. And that was one of the things I really wanted to try to do with the book as well, because once I got an angle on this, it really started to make a lot of sense that the brothers, before Roth joined, they would wear jeans and t-shirts, flannel shirts, desert boots. They didn't dress for the stage. I mean, one of the guys I interviewed in the book talked about how it looked like Alex had gotten off work at the gas station and then sat down at the drums. I mean, it was just like this. They had no stage clothing and they had no real stage presence. They just played. And of course, Roth comes on, and if you guys have, you know, paged it all through the book, you know, and imagine what it's like. And Roth was, from the beginning, was this guy who was shaking his ass, putting on the show, wearing weird clothes, what people thought. And so it was very this sort of, this things that were being pushed together that didn't seem to work. But much to the credit of Eddie and Alex, they saw what they needed, which is they needed something to help give themselves more of a stage show. And along with the fact that Eddie was sick of singing, was not a particularly good singer, you know, you bring another guy in who doesn't sing very well, but also he's the guy who's going to bring the girls, bring the party, and be, have a stage presence. And I think that was part of the thing that made it, in the mind of the Van Halen brothers, something they wanted to do, even if a lot of the guys they went to high school with who were big fans of the band didn't think it was such a good idea. But, you know, in the long run, that's the thing. Roth got better, and that was one of the great things I thought was inspirational to me as a person who wrote the book, and hopefully people will read it, is that Roth worked his ass off to get better, spent a lot of time working on his vocals, just trying to improve himself. And especially when he got to the point where he was making the record with Templeman and Don Landy, there was a lot of work put in to making sure that he could deliver on record. And Roth was a, Ted has said it to me, like, Roth was a good soldier. He was willing to work. He wasn't one of these guys who sort of said, you know, I'm done, I'm out of here. You know, you're basically, he was willing to be coached and willing to work and willing to say, I wanted to be the best I can be, and to be, despite his ego, as we all know, being to say, hey, I can, you know I can get better, and help me get better. And that's sort of what was done in the studio to kind of coach Roth up. But Roth all along the way got, you know, he worked to get, become the guy from who was sort of, you know, it was a joke when people first heard in eighth grade that Roth wanted to be a rock star. Like, anyone would think it was a joke. Anyone wanted to be a rock star in eighth grade, to the point where he made himself a rock star.
Well, I mean, I guess that actually leads us up to, you know, you're talking about Ted Templeman there, and, you know, you've been commissioned to write the book. How does that work? And then where are you at in that book?
So, you know, out of the one of the really, really great things for me as a Van Halen fan was getting the opportunity to interview Ted. I talked to him first, I think, in 2012. He was one of the last people I talked to. I would say he was the absolute last, but he was towards the end of the people I talked to. My idea with people like Ted was I wanted to make sure that I had a really good grip on the subject matter and had done a lot of homework so that when I approached people like him, that they knew that I was not just some guy who was just sort of on a lark writing a book, but that I had done my homework and I was ready to kind of go talk to them with that type of commitment to the project. And what ended up happening was after the Van Halen book was finished, Ted got the press sent Ted a copy of it, and I got this email that I had not really heard from Ted in a year or so. Maybe we exchanged a couple of emails, but I had not heard from him. And obviously his life went on, my life went on. And I got this email, and it's like Van Halen Rising. And I'm opening it with a little bit of trepidation because I'm thinking, oh, what if he hates the book? You know, the book is done. I bet. And so, but he said he really liked the book and it was great. And he was just saying that it sparked so many memories for him. And he loved understanding kind of where he had come in. Like he didn't, you know, sit down in any sort of detailed fashion and go through things with the brothers and with Dave and Mike Anthony. Like, how did you guys get here? Sort of for him to kind of understand how he sort of got entered into the Van Halen story and then how it all continued forward. So he's very complimentary about it. And then it came time for me to think about trying to do another book. And I really wanted to do another Van Halen book. And I've said this in a number of interviews before. One of the things that was immediate and it seemed obvious was, well, continue the story. Do Van Halen Rising 2, basically, or just, you know, pick it up in 1978, 79 and continue forward. And as I've said a number of times, the challenge that I thought was going to present itself pretty quickly was that as the band becomes more successful, obviously their window of, or I shouldn't say their window, their circle of people who they spend time with gets smaller and smaller. I mean, even, you know, it's like anything else. When you and this is no shot at Eddie or anybody else, when you marry Valerie Bertinelli, you're clearly not going to be hanging out with the same people you hung out with when you were growing up. It's just a different, you know, move in different circles. You have different priorities. And this is just the way fame works for anybody. Just, you know, it's just you move out of the neighborhood and things sort of change. And so they were not going to have a number of people in orbit who would be easy for me to get to. And so, you know, I could kind of go through the list of people who I would like to talk to who would be around the band. But that becomes more challenging as well without the band's participation. You know, we could go through sort of some of the obvious people, you know, Pete Angelus, Eddie Anderson, the guys who were sort of around Van Halen at the time. And they, you know, they might very well be willing to talk to me, but they're probably thinking to themselves, well, you know, what's the band think? Because again, it's sort of as you're getting closer and closer, it's becomes more obvious, you know, when they have a personal relationship in that sort of way, they might be a little bit less willing to talk without the band's participation. That's a long way of me saying, you know, I kind of know in my gut that it's pretty unlikely that I would ever, you know, that Eddie or Alex or David Lee Roth would ever sit down with me and, you know, want to talk to me about these days. Now they might, but I just didn't want to get caught in a situation where I sort of got into this and then I'm thinking I don't have the same type of raw material. I mean, that was really the advantage I had with Van Halen Rising. There was a large number of people who were there and around the band. I interviewed something like 230, 240 people. And so there was a lot of raw material there. But as you can imagine, you don't want to just sort of be rehashing Circus Magazine interviews in that type of book and leave people feeling like, well, I didn't get deliver the same thing. And so that was the one thing. But always along the way, I always was a huge fan of Ted's work. And as I got to know Ted and I started to talk more after the book came out, I just became really appreciative of his career in a different sort of way, because I started to really think and talking to him and more about his pre-Van Halen career and his whole way that he started with the Doobie Brothers and he did Carly Simon and Van Morrison. And then it sort of became, you know, evident to me that Ted was willing to spend time and talk to me about these things. He enjoyed my other book, and I approached him about doing the idea of doing a biography on him, and he sort of was like, a book on me? And I was like, well, yeah, I do a book on you. And he said, well, okay. And so that was sort of how it all started, and that was the spark for it. And I just also realized too that for me as a Van Halen fan, this isn't my sole priority for with the book, but obviously one of the priorities I wanted to try to do was just to talk about that post 1978 period of the band. And if you think about Templeman's role, Templeman's the guy who helps get Van Halen signed. I mean, he's really obviously essential to that. He brings Mo Austin down. They get Van Halen signed in 1977 at the Starwood Club. And then Ted works with Eddie and Alex and Dave and all different configurations up through 1991 with the Fuck record. Ted also does one of the Private Life records with Don Landy and Eddie in 1988 or 1989. I have to go back and probably 89 or 90. He works on that, co-produces one of those records. He does all the Van Halen first six records. Then he does the Ross solo records, the Eat 'Em and Smile, and then the EP. And so I sort of thought that was another thing to think about, is that Ted has a whole perspective on the whole saga since he was involved from sort of the beginning to the early 90s. And he saw all the breakup happen and the two careers going their divergent paths, and then how he sort of circled back and worked with Eddie and Alex and Don Landy again in the late 80s and early 90s. And so that's where the genesis of the book. In terms of where things stand with the book, I'm still writing it now, and so I don't really have a ETA when it would come out. I probably would say it's probably going to be early 2019 or late 2018, but I can't say for specificity yet until I deliver the manuscript and I'm get an ETA from the press. But I've done hours and hours of interviews with Ted. I've gone through his life from beginning to where it stands now. And I think it's going to be a book that's going to open a lot of eyes about Ted's contributions to pop music in the 80s and 90s and beyond. And then and sort of his role at Warner Brothers since he was an executive vice president. And then particularly how his role in helping to create these bands that I'm a huge fan of, Doobie Brothers and Van Halen and a whole host of other acts that he worked with along the way.
Now, one of the things, I mean, you kind of just mentioned it, like you said, you know, Eddie and Alex, you know, you don't think would sit down with you. How, with both of these books, you know, now that you're doing the work on the Ted Templeman book, how close did you come to hooking up with, you know, one of the other three guys in the band? And was that ever a consideration, or was that pretty much always off the table? Because, I mean, we know how private they are. They don't...
Well, so they were among the last people I tried to interview, and I did not. I only interviewed Mike Anthony, who was as great as you can imagine. I mean, I know his reputation precedes himself with everyone says that, but he was so gracious and so nice, and was at one point he said to me something. And of course, I'd been working on the book for quite a while before I talked to him, and he was like, "Huh, you know more about this than I do." And I, you know, he just meant that like I was just bringing up random things I'm sure he hadn't thought about. I don't think I really know more about Van Halen than he does. I just think it was these random things that were kind of coming across with the conversation. He's like, well, I haven't thought about that in a long time or whatever. So yeah. But he's a great guy. I emailed Eddie's rep, got a very polite but quick no. I didn't bother with Alex after that because I sort of figured why bother? Because I figured the way the brothers are notoriously close and have been, you know, been very tight for since they were little kids, it's clear that, you know, Alex isn't going to sit down. And the guy who's less likely to do interviews, which is Alex, who almost never does interviews, is not going to do an interview with his brother. Already said no. With Roth, I had a little bit more hope because Roth is a little more talkative. As you guys know, he will, at least historically, would talk to journalists and would do his thing. I sent a note to his rep, and it was about 2 weeks went by, and I hadn't heard back, and I wrote another note, and then I got a note back that he had passed, but I was hanging for 2 weeks for whatever that was. Either he forgot about it or whatever, or just who knows? I don't know. Maybe he thought about it. I have no idea. But that was that was sort of what I expected. But at that point, you know, they had done quite a few interviews over the years that I was able to utilize that had not been really well mined. And so one of the things I did with the book, because I spent a lot of time looking through newspapers in archives. And so when Van Halen would come to San Antonio in 1979, typically there would be, not always, but regularly, there'd be interviews that would be done by the local rock critic who would interview Van Halen. And I was able to kind of get some material there, some quotes, and some, you know, that the average Van Halen fan, I mean, the people like me, average meaning like you've read everything that you get your hands on, wouldn't have easily seen. And so that was kind of provided, I thought, a different set of of quotes and responses from those guys. And so I felt like I had, you know, quite a few bit of material. And I, you know, but that said, of course, there were things that only Eddie and Alex and Dave could have answered. And one of the questions I really wanted to ask Dave, and I've mentioned this before in other interviews, is, excuse me, Eddie, is, you know, what did you guys, Steve and your brother, think when you first rolled onto the Roth Mansion and you first saw that property, the huge house that's was just, you know, this gigantic wall around it with the pool and the tennis courts compared to the way the brothers grew up in a very modest setting. I would love to know what those guys thought about that when they first saw it. I'm sure they were just like dumbfounded that somebody could be so rich and be joining their band or whatever. So that was a whole, you know, type of things I would love to have asked them, but they all took a pass on that. And so, but thanks again to Mike Anthony, greatest guy in the world. And just he was happy to answer my questions and was great.
Awesome. I do have one more Ted Templeman question for you. In the course of interviewing him, I think one thing, you know, because when I heard you were doing the book, I, you know, did some research on Ted. You know, I'm a huge Van Halen fan, as you are, but I did not know much about him. Just to kind of tease the book a little bit, I was not aware of the artists that he had worked with outside of Van Halen. I kind of had blinders on. I was like, oh, he's the Van Halen guy. But then when he did that first Montrose record, and which was, you know, sonically the blueprint for the debut album by Van Halen. And then you get into Doobie Brothers and all these other huge artists that he worked with. What was something that you discovered in doing this so far that you think might really, you know, you don't have to go into detail because you want to sell books, obviously, but what's something you may have already found that you think is going to really surprise some people and kind of open some eyes about what he's done?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was really, really cool about Ted is that he broke three artists. And so what I mean by that is that there are producers who kind of get called in, you know, the record label assigned an artist. They've been brought to this producer and the producer makes the record, or, you know, the band is on their third producer in five records and this guy comes in and woman comes in and produces the record and it sells huge copies. You know, Ted is the guy who basically pulled the tape out of the pile, so to speak, not exactly, but for, you know, he saw Van Halen, the Doobie Brothers. He heard the demo tape and out of this, you know, listening to the team as a tape listener at Warner Brothers in 1970, like, you know, you're sort of at the bottom of job at the label. It's like, you're not in the mail room, but you've moved up to tape listener, which means you have all these cassette tapes of all these random artists. And he heard the Doobie Brothers tape and said, hey, there's something here. And then a woman by the name of Nicolette Larson, who in 1979 had a gold record and had some hits for Warner Brothers, and Ted discovered her as well. So that was one of the things I didn't really know about. I knew about the Van Halen story, that he had signed Van Halen and been the guy who'd been instrumental in saying, we need to sign this band. But to have Ted be the guy sort of to point to these three acts and be like, oh yeah, these are the ones I want. Especially again, the Doobies, with which, you know, I think the Doobie Brothers are one of these bands that are sort of so ubiquitous on radio that we hear them all the time that you don't really, it's kind of hard to explain. It's almost like Tom Petty for me. It's like, I love Tom Petty and R.I.P. Tom Petty. But you heard their records so much, it's sort of almost like you forget, like, oh my gosh, that this their impact on culture. And the same thing with the Doobie Brothers, so many big, huge records over the time. And so for Ted to be the guy who was able to be the guy who recognized the talent, the untapped talent, like seeing Van Halen at a club and when everyone else is going, singer sucks, or I hate the guitar player because he plays too loud, or I don't like their look. Where Ted to see that and go, we got to sign this band, or the Doobie Brothers to be say, hey, these guys have these some good songs. I'm going to go check this band out. We don't need to sign this band. That's I think a unique part of the Ted Templeman story, to be the guy who plucked those three artists out of obscurity and helped make them famous.
Very cool. That's pretty much what I had. I don't know. I don't think we have to get into the Sammy thing. I was going to ask you about Sammy because Ted worked with him on the.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about Sammy.
Yeah. Are you a supporter of the Sammy stuff, or are you,
I can't really tell from your Facebook post.
Yeah, I sometimes play a Sammy hater on Facebook just for the sake of being annoying to people, just to annoy people. But I had the unfortunate experience of becoming a Van Halen fan. I was 14. Jump comes out. I'd probably heard Pretty Woman before, but it had not really registered in my brain. I heard Jump. Like every other teenage kid in America at the time, was like, oh, this is great. Loved it. Saw the 84 tour. And so, you know, as you might imagine, you're super excited about the next album that's coming out, and you're hearing, oh, they're having trouble, like these little tidbits in Rolling Stone. And then you finally get the word that comes out in the summer of 84. five that the band has broken up. And so then you're sort of stuck with the two competing records. So I ended up seeing Van Halen with Sammy four or five times over the, I'm trying to remember, it's like four or five times I saw them. And so I don't have any particular axe to grind with Sammy. I prefer the Dave material. I think overall Dave material has held up much better than the Sammy material. And that's just my personal opinion, but I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of the first Montrose record. I love that record. Not just, as you guys already kind of touched on, the Sonics, the Don Landy and Ted Templeman, who did the Doobie Brothers records, made them sound so great. I mean, listen to those records in headphones, how great that those records sound. The Van Halen records, love that first Montrose record. So, you know, I have my things about Sammy that Van Halen, I'm sort of not a big enthusiast of. But again, that's one of the other things too. Ted did VOA with Sammy, and Ted had a long relationship with Sammy going back to 1973, and it stretched all the way up, to the present, obviously. But working with them as an artist up through the Fuck record, because Ted got brought in to work with Sammy on producing Sammy's vocals, because at the time in 1990, 1991, when they were making the Fuck record, Sammy was having a lot of trouble working with Andy Johns, best known for Led Zeppelin and Rolling Stones, and these other records. And so Ted came in to kind of help him finish the record and also to produce Sammy's vocals. So Ted and Sammy have this long relationship as well, which I thought, again, was kind of, as a Van Halen fan and telling Ted's story, I was very interested in that too. The head of the threads of Sammy and Dave and all these things with Ted all go back, way back.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most interesting things in the Templeman book for me is going to be hearing Ted's account of what happened, because, you know, in Sammy's biography, he described Andy Johns as just being loaded out of his brain all the time. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if Sammy has a little bit of revisionist history, or if, you know, I'd be interested to see the other side of that coin.
I don't think I'm speaking out of school here, and is that Andy was not enthusiastic. I'll just say that. Like, Andy was not happy that Ted was being brought in. As you might imagine, right? You're producing Van Halen. There are problems that are going on. And then the band approaches you and says, guess what? We're bringing in the other producer to help finish the record. In effect, to help finish the record and to work with Sammy. And so needless to say, that was not an easy set of moments for Ted. So there's some interesting stories there about how all that went down and how Ted kind of tried to smooth things over and make it work. But yeah, that was, you know, of course. And the other thing too, is that Ted is an executive at Warner Brothers. So he's an executive vice president at the time. So you can imagine, you know, when there's trouble in the Van Halen, whatever whispers they were hearing in Burbank at headquarters Warner Brothers about Van Halen, people are probably coming up to Ted and being like, you know, what's going on? You know, whatever, the record's not going to get finished or whatever. And sort of, however, that, you know, as Ted's responsibility as an executive of the label, you can imagine he probably felt like, I've got to take one for the team if I have to go in there and deal with this bullshit, where I might in another world just go, well, I, you know, sorry, guys, I'm not dealing with this situation.
Yeah, definitely.
It's funny you mentioned that you got into the band with the 1984 record, because that's exactly when I got into them, and I'm a little younger than you. I was 8 years old when that record came out. So I think like you, it was kind of like, you know, I got into 1984, and especially being a little kid, I'm like, okay, this is Van Halen. And then 5150 comes out, and I was like, well, this is a little different, but I liked it because I hadn't had that, you know, the image of Van Halen built up in my mind as being, you know, the women and children first, Fair Warning type of insanity. So being that you were right about the same time and you said you saw them both, I've always wondered, from somebody that actually is an old school Roth fan but also enjoys Sammy and has seen both, especially on, like you say, the 1984 tours and the 5150 tours, how different was that live show when Sammy first got in the band, you know, like the show that was chronicled in Live Without a Net? Like, how stark was the difference between the two shows?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that really stuck out of my mind, I remember this pretty distinctly, was that Roth on the 84 tour was in this stage where I think he had kind of, his ego had gotten to the point where he could stand up there for 15 minutes and talk and was almost doing like stand-up comedy. If you've ever like heard bootlegs from the 84 tour, I mean, go on YouTube, listen to any version of Everybody Wants Some from 1984. Like, Roth would like talk for like 10 minutes in the middle of the song. And so there was a lot of Roth talking. And then you had these very long solos, like Eddie soloing for 15 minutes on Eruption, and Mike did his solo. So that was sort of, it was, you know, in terms of, it was seemed like a much more of a disjointed thing. And at the time, I probably didn't notice it, but now thinking about what it was like, there were less songs that were played on the 5150 tour. They played a lot more songs, and they just seemed to be much more in this mode of like, let's just keep, you know, like let's go through the set list and play and crank out these tunes. And so, you know, there was the vibe that was kind of made me uncomfortable at the 5150 tour. I remember this very distinctly. There were some anti, I don't remember exactly what Sammy said. I saw them at the Meadowlands. I saw two nights on the, I think they were there for three nights at the Meadowlands. The old Brendan Byrne Arena in 86. And I feel like there were maybe both nights, there was some anti, like, it's something like, you know, something Sammy said or something. And like, people are like booing when Roth's name is mentioned or something. And I just sort of like, was like, well, that's not, that's not what I want. I mean, I don't want these guys to be friends, but I don't want to like participate in the booing of David Lee Roth. And so that I thought that was kind of shitty and just sort of juvenile, but you know, so be it. Yeah. That was kind of the thing that kind of turned me off to the whole thing was, but you know, that was kind of knowing the whole story now from inside out, you sort of understand why that was, you know, there were resentments or whatever, but yeah, like, you know, as a fan, you don't want to be like asked to like, I don't know, it's like in the middle of a divorce, you're like cheering for your mother and booing your father or something. You don't want to, you know, it's just like, right. You don't want to be sucked into that.
Exactly.
Well, very cool, man. That's all I had. Like I said, I absolutely love the book. I've read it a bunch of times, and I myself am a huge Van Halen fan. I actually knew about the book. God, man, it was had a year or more, I think, before it was even out, because one of my really good friends is actually Matt Wardlaw. I think you know him pretty well. So yeah, he's a really good friend. Yeah, he turned me on to it. So you know, when you know these little snippets would come out, he would, you know, send them over, and so it's definitely kick ass. So I can't wait to read the Templeman book. So thanks for spending some time, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, no worries. And I'll send a shout out to Matt. I said, Matt, hopefully Matt is working on his comprehensive history of Loverboy. I know Matt's a big Loverboy. <but you know. laughs>
Right. I'm sure he's hard at work as we speak.
Yeah, Matt's the best. I love Matt. So yeah, all good. Hey guys, thank you so much for doing this with me. I really appreciate it. Thanks, yeah. Guys.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Greg. Much appreciated, man.
Yeah.
Connect with Talk to Me on Facebook at facebook.com/talktometalk.
I'm not collecting friends, and I'm not building any farms. I don't want to get sucked into this.
And Twitter at talktometalk.
Yeah, once again, thanks to Greg Renoff for taking some time with us tonight. Make sure to get Van Halen Rising. You can get that Amazon or all of your favorite book outlets. And then we'll also be looking forward to that Ted Templeman book once it comes out.
Yep. I think if, I don't know if they still have it, but for anybody who's a big Van Halen fan like myself, VanHalenStore.com is where I got mine. They may still have some autographed copies, and I'm pretty sure they're not charging extra for that. So I think it's like 20-some bucks for the book, or you can, if they still have them, you can get it autographed by Greg, and it's the same price. So got that option as well.
Nice, nice. Yeah, that was a fun chat, man. He was good. I mean, you were definitely the Van Halen aficionado of the two of us, so you definitely took the realm on that one.
Yeah, like I said, I own the book. I really, really enjoy it. It was just hard not to go Van Halen fanboy with him, because I had to keep it on task, but I just wanted to talk about Van Halen and this record and that song and that story. And yeah. So had to stay focused rather than get in fanboy mode. So,
well, he had great answers too. So it wasn't hard to just ask a couple of questions and let him go. But you know, you fanned out on Greg. I'm sure I fanned out on Max Cavalera talking about Nail Bomb. So man, this has been a great episode. And, you know, any last thoughts, any additional thoughts for this week?
Yeah, just, you know, anybody that's interested in the book, if I can, you know, plug it for him, it's, you know, you and I talked about it a little bit off air, but it's, I mean, to say that he gets everybody in this book is an understatement. The people that he found to talk to are so behind the scenes, and, you know, it's like, you know, Eddie Van Halen dropped a sock, you know, at the laundromat one day, and this guy said, "Hi, Eddie," and he found him. And I mean, it's just incredible the depth that he gets into in this book. So if you are a Van Halen fan, or even just a fan of, you know, rock music in general, and you like the behind the scenes kind of things, because I know I'm kind of like that, it really is a fantastic read. And I'm not just saying that because Greg was on. I mean, it's just from a musical standpoint, if you're into those types of books, it is a fantastic, very in-depth read. So I would highly recommend it from that standpoint, even if you're not a huge Van Halen fan.
Well, there you go. So yeah, make sure to get Van Halen Rising, and then go check out Soulfly on tour for the next month or so. For the Talk to Me podcast, I am Joshua Toomey.
I'm Van Halen fanboy John Drake.
And we will talk to you guys next Thursday.